Hardship makes us stronger. That those of us who have never known a real hardship and true suffering cannot have the same strength as others who have suffered much. And if that is true, does that not mean that your argument is the same thing as saying that we have to be weak to suffer, and we have to suffer to be strong? So we have to be weak to be strong. Yes, Majid conceded, smiling. Maybe a little bit is true. Maybe a little bit of what you say. But I still think it is a matter of strength and weakness. I don't accept everything that our brother Majid said, Abdul Ghani put in. But I do agree that there is an element of control that we have over suffering. I don't think you can deny that.
Where do we get this control? And how?
Kadarbai asked. I would say that it is different for all of us, but that it happens when we grow up, when we mature and pass from the childishness of our youthful tears and become adults. I think that it is a part of growing up, learning to control our suffering. I think that when we grow up and learn that happiness is rare and passes quickly, we become disillusioned and hurt. And how much we suffer is a mark of how much we have been hurt by this realization. Suffering, you see, is a kind of anger. We rage against the unfairness, the injustice of our sad and sorry lot. And this boiling resentment, you see, this anger, is what we call suffering. It is also what leads us to the hero curse, I might add.
Hero curse! Enough of your hero curses! You bring every subject back to this, Majid growled,
scowling to match the smug smile of his portly friend.
Abdul has a pet theory, Lin, said Khaled, the dour Palestinian. He believes that certain men are cursed with qualities, such as great courage, that makes them commit desperate acts. He calls it the hero curse, the thing that compels them to lead other men to bloodshed and chaos. He might be right, I think, but he goes on about it so much he drives us all crazy.
Leaving that aside, Abdul, Kadabai persisted, let me ask you one question about what you have said. Is there a difference, would you say, between suffering that we experience and suffering that we cause for others?
Of course, yes. What are you getting at, Carter?
Just that if there are at least two kinds of suffering, quite different to each other, one that we feel and one that we cause others to feel, they can hardly both be the anger that you spoke of, isn't it so? Which one is which, would you say?
Why, Abdul Ghani laughed. You've got me there, Carter, you old fox. You always know when I'm just making an argument for the sake of it, now. And just when I thought I was being bloody clever, too. But don't worry, I'll think it around and come back at you again. He snatched a chunk of sweet barfi from the plate on the table, bit a piece of it and munched happily. He gestured to the man on his right, thrusting the sweet in his pudgy fingers.
What about you, Khaled? What have you to say about Lin's topic?
I know that suffering is the truth, Khaled said quietly. His teeth were clenched. I know that suffering is the sharp end of the whip, and not suffering is the blunt end, the end that the master holds in his hand.
Khaled, dear fellow, Abdul Ghani complained. You are more than 10 years my junior, and I think of you as dearly as I would of my own younger brother. But I must tell you that this is a most depressing thought, and you're disturbing the good pleasure we've gained from this excellent chalice.
If you'd been born and raised in Palestine, you'd know that some people are born to suffer. And it never stops for them, not for a second. You'd know where real suffering comes from. It's the same place where love and freedom and pride are born. And it's the same place where those feelings and ideals die. That suffering never stops. We only pretend it does. We only tell ourselves it does, to make the kids stop whimpering in their sleep.
He stared down at his strong hands, glowering at them as if at two despised and defeated enemies who were pleading for his mercy. A gloomy silence began to thicken in the air around us, and instinctively we looked to Kadarbai. He sat cross-legged, stiff-backed, rocking slowly in his place, and seeming to spool out a precise measure of respectful reflection. At last, he nodded to Farid, inviting him to speak.
"I think that our brother Khaled is right in a way,"
Farid began quietly, almost shyly. He turned his large, dark brown eyes on Kadarbai. Encouraged by the older man's nod of interest, he continued.
"I think that happiness is a really thing, a truly thing, but it is what makes us crazy people. Happiness is a so strange and power thing that it makes us to be sick, like a germ sort of thing. And suffering is what cures us of it, the too much happiness, the, how do you say it, barivazan?
The burden,"
Kadarbai translated for him. Farid spoke a phrase rapidly in Hindi, and Kadar gave it to us in such an elegantly poetic English that I realized, through the haze of the stone, how much better his English was than he led me to believe at our first meeting.
"The burden of happiness can only be relieved by the balm of suffering."
"Yes, yes, that is it what I want to say. Without the suffering, the happiness would squash us down."
"This is a very interesting thought, Farid," Kadarbai said,
and the young Maharashtrian glowed with pleasure in the praise. I felt a tiny twitch of jealousy. The sense of well-being bestowed by Kadarbai's benignant smile was as intoxicating as the heady mixture we'd smoked in the hookah pipe. The urge to be a son to Abdelkader Khan, to earn the blessing of his praise, was overwhelming. The hollow space in my heart, where a father's love might have been, should have been, wrapped itself around the contours of his form and took the features of his face. The high cheekbones and closely cropped silver beard, the sensual lips and deep-set amber eyes, became the perfect father's face. I look back on that time now, at my readiness to serve him as a son might serve a father, at my willingness to love him, in fact, and at how quickly and unquestioningly it happened in my life. And I wonder how much of it came from the great power that he wielded in the city, his city. I'd never felt so safe, anywhere in the world, as I did in his company. And I did hope that in the river of his life, I might wash away the scent and shake off the hounds. I've asked myself 1,000 times through the years if I would have loved him so swiftly and so well if he'd been powerless and poor. Sitting there, then, in that domed room, feeling the twinge of jealousy when he smiled at Farid and praised him, I knew that although Kadarbai had spoken of adopting me as his son on our first meeting, it was really I who'd adopted him. And while the discussion continued around me, I spoke the words quite clearly in the secret voice of prayer and incantation. "Father, Father, my Father."
"You do not share our joy at the speaking of English, Soban, uncle,"
Kadarbai said, addressing the tough, grizzled older man on his right.
"So, please, permit me to answer for you. You will say, I know, that the Quran tells us how our sin and wrongdoing is the cause of our suffering. Isn't it so?"
Soban Mahmud wagged his head in assent, his gleaming eyes nesting under a tufted ledge of grey eyebrows. He seemed amused by Kadarbai's guess at his position on the theme.
"You will say that living by right principles, according to the teachings of the Holy Quran, will banish suffering from the life of a good Muslim and lead him to the eternal bliss of heaven when life is at an end." "Now, we all know what Soban uncle thinks," Abdul Ghani cut in impatiently. "None of us will disagree with your arguments, Uncle G,
but you must permit me to say that you are inclined to be a little extreme, nah? I well remember the time when you beat young Mahmud with a rod of bamboo because he cried when his mother died. It is, of course, true that we should not question the will of Allah. But a touch of sympathy in these matters is only human, isn't it? But be that as it may, what I am interested in is your opinion, Qadr. Please tell us, what do you think about suffering? No one spoke or moved. There was a perceptible sharpening of focus and attention in the few silent moments as Qadr Bai gathered his thoughts. Each man had his own opinion and level of articulacy. Yet I had the clear impression that Qadr Bai's contribution was usually the last word. I sensed that his response would set the tone, perhaps even becoming the answer those men would give if the question about suffering were asked again. His expression was impassive, and his eyes were modestly cast down, but he was far too intelligent not to perceive the awe he inspired in others. I thought that he was far too human as well not to be flattered by it. When I came to know him better, I discovered that he was always avidly interested in what others thought of him, always acutely aware of his own charisma and its effect on those around him, and that every word he spoke, to everyone but God, was a performance. He was a man with the ambition to change the world forever. Nothing that he ever said or did, not even the quiet humility in his deep voice as he spoke to us then, was an accident, a chance, or anything but a calculated fragment of his plan.
In the first place, I would like to make a general comment, and then I would like to follow it with a more detailed answer. Do you all allow me this? Good. Then to the general comment. I think that suffering is the way we test our love. Every act of suffering, no matter how small or agonizingly great, is a test of love in some way. Most of the time, suffering is also a test of our love for God. This is my first statement. Does anyone wish to discuss this point before I proceed?
I looked from one face to another. Some men smiled in appreciation of his point. Some nodded their agreement. And some others frowned in concentration. All of them seemed eager for Qadr Bai to continue.
Very well. I will move on to my more detailed answer. The Holy Quran tells us that all things in the universe are related one to another, and that even opposites are united in some way. I think that there are two points about suffering that we should remember, and they have to do with pleasure and pain. The first is this, that pain and suffering are connected, but they are not the same thing. Pain can exist without suffering, and it is also possible to suffer without feeling pain. Do you agree with this?
He scanned the attentive, expectant faces and found approval.
The difference between them is this, I think. That what we learn from pain, for example, that fire burns and is dangerous, is always individual, for ourselves alone. But what we learn from suffering is what unites us as one human people. If we do not suffer with our pain, then we have not learned about anything but ourselves. Pain without suffering is like victory without struggle. We do not learn from it what makes us stronger or better or closer to God.
The others wagged their heads at one another in agreement.
And the other part? The pleasure part? Abdul Ghani asked.
A few of the men laughed gently, grinning at Ghani as he looked from one to the other. He laughed at them in return.
What? What? Can't a man have a healthy scientific interest in pleasure?
Ah, Qadr continued. I think that it's a little bit like what Mr. Lin tells us this Shapna fellow has done with the words from the Christian Bible. It is the reverse. Suffering is exactly like happiness, but backwards. One is the mirror image of the other, and has no real meaning or existence without the other.
I'm sorry, I do not understand,
Farid said meekly, glancing at the others and blushing darkly.
Please, can you explain it?
It is like this,
Kadarbai said gently.
Take my hand as an example. If I open my hand out like this, stretching the fingers and showing you the palm, or if I open my hand and put it on your shoulder, my fingers stretched out like this, that is happiness, or we may call it so for the sake of this moment. And if I curl my fingers and close them tightly into a fist, just so, we may call that suffering. The two gestures are opposite in their meaning and power. Each one is completely different in appearance and in what it can do. But the hand that makes the gesture is the same. Suffering is happiness backwards.
Each man was then given another turn to speak, and the discussion itself moved backwards and forwards, reversing on itself as arguments were embellished or abandoned for 2 long hours. Hashish was smoked, tea was served twice more, Abdul Ghani choosing to mix a small pellet of black opium in his, and drinking it down with a practiced grimace. Majid modified his position by agreeing that suffering was not necessarily a sign of weakness, but insisting that we could toughen ourselves against it with a strong will. Strength of will coming from strict self-discipline, a kind of self-imposed suffering. Farid added to his notion of suffering as an antitoxin to the poison of happiness by recalling specific incidents from the lives of his friends. Old Soban whispered a few sentences in Urdu, and Kadarbai translated the new point for us. There are some things we human beings will never understand, the things only God can understand, and that suffering may well be one of them. Keki Dorabji made the point that the universe, as those of the Parsi faith see it, is a process of struggle between opposites. Light and darkness, hot and cold, suffering and pleasure. And that nothing can exist without the existence of its opposite. Rajubai added that suffering is a condition of the unenlightened soul, locked within the wheel of karma. Khaled Ansari said nothing more, despite the artful urgings of Abdul Ghani, who teased and cajoled him several times before finally giving up the attempt, visibly piqued by the stubborn refusal. For his part, Abdul Ghani emerged as the most vocal and likable of the group. Khaled was an intriguing man, but there was anger, too much anger perhaps, brooding in him. Majid had been a professional soldier in Iran. He seemed brave and direct, yet given to a simplistic view of the world and its people. Soban Mahmud was undoubtedly pious, but there was a vaguely antiseptic scent of inflexibility about him. Young Farid was open-hearted, self-effacing, and, I suspected, too easily led. Keki was dour and unresponsive, and Rajubai seemed to be suspicious of me, almost to the point of rudeness. Of all of them, only Abdul Ghani displayed any sense of humour, and only he laughed aloud. He was as familiar with younger men as he was with those senior to him. He sprawled in his place where others sat. He interrupted or interjected when he pleased, and he ate more, drank more, and smoked more than any man in the room. He was especially irreverently affectionate with Kadarbai, and it was certain that they were close friends. Kadarbai asked questions, probed, made comments upon what was said, but never added another word to his own position. I was silent, drifting, tired, and grateful that no one pressured me to speak. When Kadarbai finally adjourned the meeting, he walked with me to the door that opened into the street beside the Nabila Mosque and stopped me there with a gentle hand on my forearm. He said he was glad I'd come and that he hoped I'd enjoyed myself. Then he asked me to return on the following day because there was a favour I could do for him, if I was willing. Surprised and flattered, I agreed at once, promising to meet him at the same place on the following morning. I stepped out into the night and almost put it out of my mind. On the long walk home, my thoughts browsed among the ideas I'd heard presented by that scholarly group of criminals. I recalled other similar discussions I'd shared with men in prison. Despite their general lack of formal education, or perhaps because of it, many men I'd known in prison had a fervent interest in the world of ideas. They didn't call it philosophy, or even know it as such. But the stuff of their conversations was often just that. Abstract questions of moral and ethic, meaning and purpose. It had been a long day, and an even longer night. With Madame Jo's photograph in my hip pocket, my feet pinched by shoes that had been bought to bury Carla's dead lover, and my head clogged with definitions of suffering, I walked the emptying streets and remembered a cell in an Australian prison, where the murderers and thieves I'd called my friends often gathered to argue, passionately, about truth and love and virtue. I wondered if they thought of me from time to time. Am I a daydream for them now? I asked myself. A daydream of freedom and flight? How would they answer the question, what is suffering? I knew. Kadarbai had dazzled us with the wisdom of his uncommon sense and the cleverness of his talent for expressing it. His definition was sharp and barbed enough, suffering is happiness, backwards, to hook a fish of memory. But the truth of what human suffering really means, in the dry, frightened mouth of life, wasn't in Kadarbai's cleverness that night. It belonged to Khaled Ansari, the Palestinian. His was the definition that stayed with me. His simple, unbeautiful words were the clearest expression of what all prisoners and everyone else who lives long enough know well. That suffering, of every kind, is always a matter of what we've lost. When we're young, we think that suffering is something that's done to us. When we get older, when the steel door slams shut in one way or another, we know that real suffering is measured by what's taken away from us. Feeling small and alone and lonely, I walked by memory and touch through the dark, lightless lanes of the slum. As I turned into the last gully where my own empty hut waited, I saw lamplight. A man was standing not far from my door with a lantern in his hand. Beside him was a small child, a little girl, with knotted, teased hair. I drew near and saw that the man with the lantern was Joseph, the drunkard who'd beaten his wife, and that Prabhakar was with him in the shadows. "What's going on?" I whispered. "It's late."
"Hello, Lin Baba. Nice clothes you're wearing for changes,"
Prabhakar smiled, his round face floating in the yellow light.
"I love it, your shoes. So clean and shining. Just in time you are. Joseph is doing it good things. He has paid money to have it the good luck sign put on everybody his doors. Since not being a badly drinking fellow anymore, he has been working full overtimes, and with some of his extra money he paid for this, to help us all with good luck."
"The good luck sign?"
"Yes. Look here at this child. Look at her hand."
He lifted the little girl's wrists and exposed the hands. In the feeble light, it wasn't clear what I was supposed to see.
"Look here. Only four fingers she has. See that? Four fingers only. Very good luck, this thing."
I saw it. Two fingers on the child's hands were joined, imperceptibly, to make just one thick finger between the index and middle fingers. Her palms were blue. Joseph held a flat dish of blue paint. The child had been dipping her hands into it and making handprints on the door of every hut in our lane to bring protection against the many afflictions attributed to the evil eye. Superstitious slum dwellers apparently deemed her to be especially blessed because she was born with the rare difference of only four fingers on each hand. As I watched, the child reached over to press her small hands against my flimsy door. With a brief, serious nod, Joseph led the girl away to the next hut.
I am helping that used to be beating his wife and badly drinking fellow, that Joseph,
Prabhaka said, in a stage whisper that could be heard 20 meters away.
You are wanting any things before I am going?
No, thanks. Good night, Prabhu.
Shubha Ratri, Lin,
he grinned. Good night.
Have it sweet dreams for me, yes?
He turned to leave, but I stopped him. Hey, Prabhu.
Yes, Lin?
Tell me, what is suffering? What do you think? What does it mean that people suffer? Prabhaka glanced along the dark lane of ramshackle huts to the hovering glowworm of Joseph's lamp. He looked back at me, only his eyes and his teeth visible, although we were standing quite close together.
You're feeling okay, Lin?
I'm fine, I laughed.
Did you drink any daru tonight, like that badly drinking Joseph?
No, really, I'm fine. Come on, you're always defining everything for me. We were talking about suffering tonight, and I'm interested to know, what do you think about it?
It's easy. Suffering is hungry, isn't it? Hungry for anything means suffering. Not hungry for something means not suffering. But everybody knows that.
Yes, I guess everybody does. Good night, Prabhu.
Good night, Lin.
He walked away, singing. And he knew that none of the people sleeping in the wretched huts around him would mind. He knew that if they woke, they would listen for a moment and then drift back to sleep with a smile, because he was singing about love. Chapter 15.
Wake up, Lin. Hey, Lin Baba. You must have wake up now.
One eye opened and focused on a hovering brown balloon that had Johnny Cigar's face painted on it. The eye closed again.
Go away, Johnny.
Hello to you too, Lin, he chuckled, infuriatingly happy. You have to get up.
You're an evil man, Johnny. You're a cruel and evil man. Go away.
One fellow has an injury, Lin. We need your medicine box, and your good medical self also.
It's still dark, man, I groaned. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Tell him to come back in the daylight when I'm alive.
Oh, certainly I will tell him, and he will go. But I think you should know that he is bleeding very swiftly. Still, if you must have more sleep, I will beat him away from your door this very instant with 3-4 good shots from my slipper.
I was leaning out over the deep pool of sleep, but that word, bleeding, pulled me back from the edge. I sat up, wincing at the numbed stiffness of one hip. My bed, like most of the beds in the slum, was a blanket, folded twice and placed on the hard-packed earth. Kapok mattresses were available, but they were impractical. They took up too much space in the small huts. They quickly became infested with lice, fleas, and other vermin, and rats found them irresistible. After long months of sleeping on the ground, I was as used to it as a man gets, but there wasn't much flesh on my hips, and I woke up sore every morning. Johnny was holding a lamp quite close to my face. I blinked, pushing it aside to see another man squatting in the doorway, with his arm held out in front of him. There was a large cut or gash on the arm, and blood seeped from it, drip, drip, drop, into a bucket. Only half awake as I was, I stared stupidly at the yellow plastic bucket. The man had brought his own bucket with him to stop the blood from staining the floor of my hut, and that seemed more disturbing somehow than the wound itself.
Sorry for trouble, Mr. Lin, the young man said.
This is Amir, Johnny Cigar grunted, whacking the injured man on the back of the head with a resounding slap. Such a stupid fellow he is, Lin. Now he's sorry for trouble. I should take my slipper and beat your black and beat some of your blue also.
God, what a mess. This is a bad cut, Johnny.
It was a long, deep slash from the shoulder almost to the tip of the elbow. A large triangular flap of skin, shaped like the lapel of an overcoat, was beginning to curl away from the wound.
He needs a doctor,
This has to be stitched up. You should have taken him to the hospital.
Hospital, Naya!
Amir whined.
Nahin, Baba!
Johnny slapped him on the ear.
Shut up, you stupid! He won't go to a hospital or a doctor, Lin. He's a cheeky fellow, a gunda. He's afraid of police. Aren't you, hey, you stupid? Afraid of police, nah?
Stop hitting him, Johnny. It's really not helping. How did this happen?
Fighting. His gang with the other gang. They fight with swords and choppers, these street gangsters. And this is the result.
The other fellow started it. They were doing the Eve teasing,
Amir complained. Eve teasing was the name given to the charge of sexual harassment under Indian law, and it covered a range of offences, from insulting language to physical molestation.
We warned them to stop it. Our ladies were not working safely. For that reason only we did fight them.
Johnny raised his broad hand, silencing Amir's protest. He wanted to strike the young man again, but my frown gave him reluctant pause.
You think this is a reason to fight with swords and choppers, you stupid? Your mummy will be very happy that you stopped the Eve teasing and get yourself hacked up into teeny pieces, nah? Very happy she'll be. And now you want Lin Baba to sew you up and make nice repairs to your arm. Shameful you are.
Wait a minute, Johnny. I can't do this. It's too big, too messy. It's too much.
You have the needles and cotton in your medical boxes, Lin.
He was right. The kit contained suture needles and silk thread, but I'd never used them. I've never used them, Johnny. I can't do it. He needs a professional, a doctor or a nurse.
I told you, Lin, he won't go to a doctor. I tried to force him. Someone in the other gang was hurt even more seriously than this stupid boy. Maybe he will die also, this other fellow. It is a police matter now, and they're asking questions. Amir won't go to any doctor or hospital.
If you give me, I will do myself,
Amir said, swallowing hard. His eyes were huge with fright and horror-struck resolve. I looked at him full in the face for the first time, and I saw how young he was, 16 or 17 years old. He was wearing puma sneakers, jeans, and a basketball singlet with the number 23 printed on the front. The clothes were Indian copies of famous Western brands, but they were considered fashionably hip by his peers in the slum. Other young men with lean bellies and heads full of scrambled foreign dreams. Young men who went without food to buy clothes that they imagined made them look like the cool foreigners in magazines and films. I didn't know the kid. He was one of thousands I'd never seen, although I'd been there for almost 6 months, and no one in the place lived more than 500 or 600 metres from my hut. Some men, such as Johnny Cigar and Prabhaka, appeared to know everyone in the slum. It seemed extraordinary to me that they should know intimate details from the lives of so many thousands of people. It was even more remarkable that they cared, that they encouraged and scolded and worried about all of them. I wondered how that young man was connected to Johnny Cigar. Amir shivered in the swirling chill of night, pressing his lips into a wide, noiseless whine as he contemplated taking needle and thread to his own flesh. I wondered how it was that Johnny, standing above him, knew him well enough to be sure he would do it, to nod at me with the message, "Yes, if you give him the needle, he will do it himself." "Okay, okay, I'll do it," I surrendered. "It's going to hurt. I haven't got any anesthetic."
"Hurt?" Johnny boomed happily. "Pain is no problem, Lin. Good you have pains, Amir, you chutya. Pains in your brains you should be having."
I sat Amir down on my bed, covering his shoulders with another blanket. Pulling the kerosene stove from my kitchen box, I pumped it up, primed it, and set a pot of water on it to boil. Johnny hurried off to ask someone to make hot sweet tea. I washed my face and hands hurriedly, in the dark, at the open bathroom space beside my hut. When the water boiled, I put a little into a dish and threw two needles into the pot to sterilize them with further boiling. Using antiseptic and warm soapy water, I washed the wound and then dried it off with clean gauze. I bound the arm tightly with gauze, leaving it in place for 10 minutes to press the wound together, in the hope that it would make the stitching easier.
Amir drank two large mugs of sweet tea at my insistence, as a counter to the symptoms of shock that had begun to show. He was afraid, but he was calm. He trusted me. He couldn't know that I'd only done the procedure once before, and under ironically similar circumstances. A man had been stabbed during a prison fight. The problem between the two antagonists, whatever it was, had been resolved in the violent encounter, and the matter was finished so far as they were concerned. But if the stabbed man had reported to the prison infirmary for treatment, the authorities would have placed him in an isolation unit for prisoners on protection. For some men, child molesters and informers particularly, there was no alternative to being placed on protection, because they wouldn't otherwise have survived. For others, men placed there against their will, the protection unit was a curse. The curse of suspicion, slanders, and the company of men they despised. The stabbed man had come to me. I'd stitched his wound closed with a leatherwork needle and embroidery thread. The wound healed, but it left an ugly, rippling scar. The memory of it never left me, and I wasn't confident about the attempt to stitch Amir's arm. The sheepish, trusting smile that the young man offered me was no help. "People always hurt us with their trust," Carla said to me once. "The surest way to hurt someone you like is to put all your trust in him." I drank tea, smoked a cigarette, and then set to work. Johnny stood in the doorway, ineffectually scolding several curious neighbours and their children away from the door. The suture needle was curved and very fine. I supposed that it should have been used with some kind of pliers. I had none in my kit. One of the boys had borrowed them to fix a sewing machine. I had to push the needle into the skin and pull it through with my fingers. It was awkward and slippery, and the first few cross-shaped stitches were messy. Amir winced and grimaced inventively, but he didn't cry out. By the fifth and sixth stitches, I developed a technique, and the ugliness of the work, if not the pain involved, had diminished. Human skin is tougher and more resilient than it looks. It's also relatively simple to stitch, and the thread can be pulled quite tightly without tearing the tissue. But the needle, no matter how fine or sharp, is still a foreign object. And for those of us who aren't inured to such work through frequent repetition, there's a psychological penalty that must be paid each time we drive that alien thing into another being's flesh. I began to sweat heavily despite the cool night. It was a measure of the distress involved that Amir became brighter as the work progressed, while I grew more tense and fatigued. "You should have insisted that he go to a hospital," I snapped at Johnny Cigar. "This is ridiculous."
"You're doing very excellent sewing, Lynn," he countered. "You could make up a very fine shirt with stitches like that."
"It's not as good as it should be. He'll have a big scar. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here."
"You're having trouble with toilet, Lynn."
"What?
Are you not going to the toilet? Are you having it hard motions?"
"For Christ's sakes, Johnny, what are you babbling about?"
"You're bad temper, Lynn. This is not your usual behavior. Maybe it is a problem with hard motions, I think so."
"No," I groaned.
"Ah, then it is loose motions you're having, I think."
"He had it loose motions for 3 days last month,"
one of my neighbors chipped in from the open doorway.
"My husband told me that Lin Baba was going 3-4 times to toilet every day then, and again 3-4 times every night. The whole street was talking." "Oh, yes, I remember," another neighbor recalled. "Such pain he had. What faces he pulled when he was at the toilet, yeah, like he was making a baby. And it was a very runny, loose motion, like water it was. And it came out so fast, like when they explode the cannons on Independence Day. Da-dong! Like that it was. I recommended the drinking of Chando Chai that time, and his motions became harder and a very good color again."
"A good idea," Johnny muttered appreciatively. "Go and get it some Chando Chai for Lin Baba's loose motions."
"No," I moaned. "I don't have loose motions. I don't have hard motions. I haven't had a chance to have any motions at all yet. I'm only half awake, for God's sake. Oh, what's the use? There, it's finished. You'll be okay, Amir, I think. But you should have a tetanus injection."
No need, Lin Baba. I had the injections before 3 months, after the last fighting.
I cleaned the wound once more and dusted it with antibiotic powder. Covering the 26 stitches with a loose bandage, I warned him not to get it wet and instructed him to come back within 2 days to have it checked. He tried to pay me, but I refused the money. No one paid for the treatment I dispensed. Still, it wasn't principle that made me refuse. The truth was that I felt curiously, inexplicably angry at Amir, at Johnny, at myself, and I ordered him away curtly. He touched my feet and backed out of the hut, collecting a parting slap on the head from Johnny Cigar. I was about to clean up the mess in my hut when Prabhakar rushed inside, grasped at my shirt, and tried to drag me out through the door.
"So good that you're not sleeping, Lin Baba," he gasped breathlessly. "We can save the time of waking you up. You must come now with me. Hurry, please."
"For God's sake, what is it now?" I grumbled. "Let go of me, Prabhu. I've got to clean up this mess."
"No time for mess, Baba. You come now, please. No problem."
"Yes, problem," I contradicted him. "I'm not going anywhere until you tell me what the hell is going on. That's it, Prabhu. That's final. No problem."
"You absolutely must come, Lin," he insisted, dragging at my shirt. "Your friend is in the jail. You must help."
We abandoned the hut and rushed out through the narrow, shadow-clogged lanes of the sleeping slum. On the main street outside the President Hotel, we caught a cab and swept along the clean, silent streets, past the Parsi Colony, Sassoon Dock, and the Colaba Market. The cab stopped outside the Colaba police station, directly across the road from Leopold's. The bar was closed, of course, with the wide metal shutters rolled down to the pavement. It seemed preternaturally quiet, the haunted stillness of a popular bar closed for business. Prabhakar and I passed the gates of the police station and entered the compound. My heart was beating fast, but I looked outwardly calm. All the cops in the station spoke Marathi. It was a requirement of their employment. I knew that if they had no special reason to suspect or challenge me, my proficiency with the Marathi language would please them as much as it surprised them. It would make me popular with them, and that small celebrity would protect me. Still, it was a journey behind enemy lines, and in my mind I pushed the locked, heavy box of fear all the way to the back of the attic. Prabhakar spoke quietly to a havaldar, or police constable, at the foot of a long flight of metal stairs. The man nodded and stepped to the side. Prabhakar wagged his head, and I followed him up the steel steps to a landing with a heavy door on the first floor. A face appeared at the grill set into the door. Large brown eyes stared left and right, and then the door opened for us. We stepped into an antechamber that contained a desk, a small metal chair, and a bamboo cot. The guard who opened the door was the watchman on duty that night. He spoke briefly with Prabhakar and then glared at me. He was a tall man with a prominent paunch and a large, expressively bristly moustache tinged with grey. There was a metal gate made from hinged concertina-style lattices behind him. Beyond the gate, the faces of a dozen prisoners watched us with intense interest. The guard turned his broad back on them and held out his hand.
"He wants you to..." Prabhakar began.
"I know," I stopped him, fishing into the pocket of my jeans. "He wants bakshish. How much?"
50 rupees.
Prabhakar grinned, looking up with his biggest smile into the face of the tall officer. I handed over a 50-rupee note, and the watchman palmed it. He turned his back to me and approached the metal gate. We followed him. More men had gathered there, all wide awake and chattering despite the late hour. The watchman stared at them, one by one, until all were silent. Then he called me forward. When I faced the bars of the steel gate, the crowd of men parted, and two fantastic figures pushed their way to the front. They were the bear handlers, the blue-skinned men who'd brought Kano the bear to my slum at Abdullah's request. They reached the gate and grasped at the bars, chattering at me so quickly and urgently that I caught only every fourth or fifth word. "What's going on, Prabhu?" I asked, completely mystified.
When Prabhakar told me that my friend was in jail, I'd assumed that he'd meant Abdullah. I was expecting to find Abdullah behind the bars, and I moved left and right, trying to see beyond the bear handlers and the other men crowding at the gate.
"These are your friends, isn't it?" Prabhakar asked. "Don't you remember, Lin? They came with Kano to have your bear hugs."
"Yes, sure, I remember them. Did you bring me to see them?" Prabhakar blinked at me, and then turned quickly to check the expressions on the faces of the watchmen and the bear handlers.
"Yes, Lin," he said quietly. "These men were asking you to come. Do you want to leave?"
No, I just... "Never mind. What do they want? I can't make out what they're saying." Prabhakar asked them to explain what they wanted, and the two blue-skinned men shouted their story, clutching at the lattices of the gate, as if they were the boards of a raft on the open sea.
"They say, they tell it, that they are staying near to the Navy Nagar, and they found there some other fellows, who are also bear-handling fellows, and having it one very sad and skinny bear," Prabhakar explained, urging the men to be calm and to speak more slowly. "They say that these others were not treating their bear with respect. They were beating that bear with a whip, and that bear was crying with pains all over him."
The bear handlers spoke in a rush of words that kept Prabhakar silent, listening and nodding, with his mouth open to speak. Other prisoners approached the gate to listen. The corridor beyond the gate had long windows on one side, covered by a metal grill. On the other side of the crowded prison corridor, there were several rooms. Men streamed from those rooms, swelling the throng at the gate to 100 or more prisoners, all of them listening with fascination to the bear handler's story.
"So hard those bad fellows were beating their poor bear," Prabhakar translated. "And even when it cried, those fellows didn't stop beating at that bear. And you know, it was a girl bear."
The men at the gate reacted with outraged, angry shouts and sympathetic cries.
"Our fellows here, they were very upset about the others beating that other bear. So they went up to those others and they told them they must not be beating any bear. But they were very bad and angry, those fellows. There was a lot of shouting and pushing and bad language. One of those fellows, he called our fellows the sister fuckers. Our fellows, they called the other ones the assholes. The bad ones, they call our fellows motherfucking bastards. Our fellows, they call them brother fuckers. The other ones, they said a lot more about something and anything fucking. Our fellows, they said back a lot about..."
"Get to the point, Prabhu."
"Yes, Lin,"
he said, listening intently. There was a lengthy pause. "Well," I demanded.
"Still a lot of bad language, Lin," he replied, shrugging helplessly. "But some of it, I have to say, is very, very fine, if you want to hear it."
"No."
"Okay," he said at last. "At the end, somebody called it the police to come. Then there was a big fight."
He paused again, listening to the next installment of the story. I turned to look at the watchman and saw that he was as deeply engrossed in the unfolding saga as the prisoners were. He chewed pan as he listened, his thorn bush of a moustache twitching up and down, and unconsciously emphasizing his interest. A roar of approval for something in the story went up from the attentive prisoners, and the watchman was united with them in the appreciative shout.
"At first, the other fellows were winning that big fight. So much fighting there was, Lin, like in Mahabharata. Those bad fellows had a few friends who all made a contribution of punches and kicking and slapping with slippers. Then, Kano the bear, he got upset. Just before the police arrived, Kano the bear got into that fight to help his bear-handling fellows. He stopped that fight too fast. He was knocking those other fellows right and left also. That Kano is a very good fighting bear. He beat those bad fellows and all their friends and gave them a solid pasting."
"And then the blue guys got arrested," I concluded for him.
"So to say it, yes. Arrested they were for the charge of breaking the pieces."
"Okay, let's talk." Prabhakar, the watchman, and I took two steps away from the gate and stood at the bare metal desk.
Over my shoulder, I could see that the men at the gate were straining to hear our conversation. What's the Hindi word for bail, Prabhu? Find out if we can bail the guys out of jail. Prabhakar asked, but the watchman shook his head and told us that it was out of the question. Is it possible for me to pay the fine? I asked in Marathi, using the commonly accepted euphemism for a police bribe. The watchman smiled and shook his head. A policeman was hurt in the scuffle, he explained, and the matter was out of his hands. Shrugging my helplessness, I turned back to the gate and told the men that I couldn't bail or bribe them out of the jail. They rattled away at me in such a swift and garbled Hindi that I couldn't understand them.
No, Lin, Prabhakar announced, beaming a smile at me. They don't worry for themselves. They worry for Kano. He is arrested also, that bear. They are very worried for their bear. That is what they want you to help them for.
The bear is arrested? I asked the watchman in Marathi.
Ji? Ha! He replied,
a flourish of pride rippling in his wild moustache. Sir? Yes.
The bear is in custody downstairs.
I looked at Prabhakar and he shrugged.
Maybe we should see it, that bear, he suggested.
I think we should see it, that bear, I replied.
We took the steel steps down to the ground floor level and were directed to a row of cells directly beneath the rooms we'd seen upstairs. A ground level watchman opened one of the rooms and we leaned inside to see Kano the bear sitting in the middle of a dark and empty cell. It was a large room with a keyhole toilet in the floor in one corner. The huge muzzled bear was chained at his neck and on his paws, and the chains passed through a metal grill at one of the windows. He sat with his broad back against a wall, and his lower legs splayed out in front of him. His expression, and I have no other way of describing the set of his features other than as an expression, was disconsolate and profoundly distressed. He let out a long, heart-wrenching sigh, even as we watched him. Prabhakar was standing a little behind me. I turned to ask him a question, and found that he was crying, his face contorted with miserable sobbing. Before I could speak, he moved past me toward the bear, evading the outstretched hand of the watchman. He reached Kano with his arms before him in a wide embrace, and pressed himself to the creature, resting his head against Kano's and stroking the shaggy fur with murmurs of tenderness. I exchanged glances with the ground-level watchman. The man raised his eyebrows and wagged his head from side to side energetically. He was clearly impressed.
I did that first, you know, I found myself saying in Marathi. A few weeks ago, I hugged that bear first.
The watchman wrinkled his lips in a pitying and contemptuous sneer.
Of course you did, he mocked. Absolutely you did.
Prabhakar, I called out. Can we get on with this?
He pulled himself away from the bear and approached me, wiping tears from his eyes with the backs of his hands as he walked. His wretchedness was so complete that I was moved to put my arm around him to comfort him.
I hope you are not minding, Lin, he cautioned. I smell quite much like bears.
It's okay, I answered him softly. It's okay. Let's see what we can do. 10 more minutes of discussion with the watchman and the other guards resolved that it was impossible for us to bail out the handlers or their bear. There was nothing to be done. We returned to the metal gate and informed the bear handlers that we were unable to help them. They broke into another animated dialogue with Prabhakar.
They know all that we cannot be helping, Prabhakar
clarified for me after a few minutes.
What they want is to be in that lock-up cell with Kano. They are worried for Kano because he is lonely. Since a baby, he has never been sleeping alone, even one night. For that only they are big worried. They say that Kano, he will be frightened. He will have a bad sleep and have too many bad dreams. He will be crying for his loneliness. And he will be ashamed to be in the jail because he is normally a very fine citizen, that bear. They want only to go down to that lock-up cell with Kano and keep him some good companies.
One of the bear handlers stared into my eyes when Prabhakar finished his explanation. The man was distraught. His face was creased with worry. Anguish drew his lips back into something that resembled a snarl. He repeated one phrase again and again, hoping that with repetition and the force of his emotion, he might make me understand. Suddenly, Prabhakar burst into tears once more, sobbing like a child as he grasped the metal bars of the gate.
"What's he saying, Prabhu?"
"He says a man must love his Berlin," Prabhakar translated for me. "He says like that, a man must love his bear."
Negotiations with the watchman and the other guards were spirited once we presented them with a request that they could grant without bending the rules to their breaking point. Prabhakar thrived in the theatrically energetic barter, protesting and pleading with equal vigour. At last he arrived at an agreed sum, 200 rupees, about 12 American dollars, and the mustachioed watchman unlocked the gate for the bear handlers, while I handed over the bundle of notes. In a strange procession of people and purposes, we filed down the steel stairs, and the ground floor watchman unlocked the cell that housed Kano. At the sound of their voices, the great bear rose from his seated position, and then fell forward on all fours, dragged downward by the chains. The bear swayed its head from side to side in a joyful dance and pawed at the ground. When the bear handlers rushed to greet him, Kano drove his snout into their armpits and nuzzled in their long, dreadlocked hair, snuffling and sniffing at their scent. For their part, the blue men smothered him in affectionate caresses and sought to ease the stress of the heavy chains. We left them in the enclosure of that embrace. When the steel cell door slammed shut on Kano and his handlers, the sound rattled through the empty parade ground, gouging echoes from the stone. I felt that sound as a shiver in my spine as Prabhakar and I walked out of the police compound.
"It is a very fine thing that you have done tonight, Limbaba," Prabhakar gushed. "A man must love his bear. That is what they said, those bear-handling fellows, and you have made it come true. It is a very, very, very fine thing that you have done."
We woke a sleeping cab driver outside the police station on Kalaba Causeway. Prabhakar joined me in the back seat, enjoying the chance to play tourist in one of the cabs he frequently drove. As the taxi pulled out from the curb, I turned to see that he was staring at me. I looked away. A moment later, I turned my head and found that he was still staring. I frowned at him, and he wagged his head. He smiled his world-embracing smile for me and placed his hand over his heart. "What?" I asked irritably, although his smile was irresistible, and he knew it, and I was already smiling with him in my heart.
"A man," he began, intoning the words with sacramental solemnity.
"Not again, Prabhu."
"Must love his bear," he concluded,
patting at his chest and wagging his head frantically. "Oh, God help me," I moaned, turning again to look at the awkward stir and stretch of the waking street. At the entrance to the slum, Prabhakar and I separated as he made his way to Kumar's chai shop for an early breakfast. He was excited. Our adventure with Kano the bear had given him a fascinating new story, with himself cast in an important role, to share with Parvati, one of Kumar's two pretty daughters. He hadn't said anything to me about Parvati, but I'd seen him talking to her, and I guessed that he was falling in love. In Prabhakar's way of courtship, a young man didn't bring flowers or chocolates to the woman he loved. He brought her stories from the wider world, where men grappled with demons of desire and monstrous injustice. He brought her gossip and scandals and intimate secrets. He brought her the truth of his brave heart and the mischievous, awe-struck wonder that was the wellspring of his laughter and of that sky-wide smile. And as I watched him scurry toward the chai shop, I saw that already his head was wagging and his hands were waving as he rehearsed the story that he brought to her as the new day's gift. I walked on into the grey pre-morning as the slum murmured itself awake. Smoke swirling from 100 small fires roved the lanes. Figures wrapped in coloured shawls emerged
and vanished in the misty streams. The smell of rotis cooking on kerosene stoves and chai boiling in fragrant pots joined the people smells of coconut hair oil, sandalwood soap, and camphor-soaked clothing.